Today, we are looking at a company that achieved just total unquestioned market dominance by actively ignoring what a lot of people consider to be the most sacred rule of modern Silicon Valley.
Oh, absolutely. The golden rule.
Right, because for the last 2 decades, the prevailing wisdom has always been that open platforms win. I mean, we saw it with Linux dominating the server market.
Yeah, and Android taking over the vast majority of the global mobile market.
Exactly. The classic playbook says you build an open ecosystem, you invite everyone to collaborate, and you just commoditize the underlying hardware so you can scale infinitely.
Right, you make it cheap and ubiquitous.
But the company we are dissecting today did the exact opposite of that. They completely refused to build an open platform.
They really did. They built this incredibly highly specialized, relentlessly closed hardware and software ecosystem.
Right, they locked the doors. They controlled every single variable. And by doing that, they somehow became the sole supplier of the only infrastructure capable of powering the next generation of global computing.
Which forces a complete reevaluation of how we even understand competitive strategy. I mean, traditional business analysis assumes this sort of zero-sum game within established boundaries, you know.
They're like, you build a slightly faster product or you undercut on price.
Yeah, and you fight tooth and nail for like a 2% gain in market share. But what we are analyzing today is something entirely different. It is the absolute definition of a paradigm shift.
We're not looking at incremental market capture here.
No, not at all.
Huh.
We are deconstructing the actual architecture of total market creation.
Well, welcome to this deep dive. If you are listening to this right now, you are likely a technology executive, a business leader, or maybe a strategist trying to separate the actual signal from all the noise out there.
And there's a lot of noise.
So much noise. So our mission today is to deliver a rigorous, uncompromising executive audio briefing tailored specifically for you. We are stripping away the mainstream hype.
Yeah, we're ignoring the daily stock ticker obsession entirely.
Exactly. Setting aside all that generic, breathless praise about artificial intelligence, to look at the cold, hard mechanics of how a monopoly is actually engineered.
And to really ground this conversation, we are relying exclusively on this phenomenal piece of strategic analysis by author Victor Holman.
He really did the heavy lifting for us here.
He absolutely did. Sparked by a deep review of NVIDIA's recent annual meeting of stockholders, Holman basically went down the rabbit hole.
Right.
He synthesized years of annual reports, these highly technical press releases, independent architectural breakdowns, and his own extensive operational notes.
And his thesis really zeroes in on three main pillars of modern tech dominance, right?
Yeah, exactly. Full stack integration, the creation of unbreakable network effects, and a fundamental reshaping of the economics of computing.
You are going to walk away from this briefing with a literal masterclass in platform strategy, because at its core, this isn't just some story about a silicon chip company that got lucky with a hardware trend.
No, it's a masterclass in visionary resource allocation. It's about anticipating bottlenecks literally years before they happen.
And having the sheer corporate discipline to build entirely new multi-billion dollar oceans rather than, fighting for scraps in crowded ponds.
Exactly. But to understand the massive globe-spanning data centers of today, we really cannot start in the present.
No, we have to go back to a very specific moment in time. We need to look at the singular trigger point that changed the entire trajectory of the computing industry.
Right, let's take it back to 2012.
2012, which is effectively ground zero for the modern AI era.
Yes. And it all revolves around this major breakthrough in computer vision during an academic competition. It was a model known as AlexNet.
AlexNet. But to really get why AlexNet was such a shockwave, we have to look at the state of computing right before it happened.
Right, because up until that point, the entire tech industry was built around the central processing unit, the CPU.
The CPU, the ultimate generalist.
Exactly. It can do anything you ask it to do, right? It can run your operating system, open a spreadsheet, manage a massive database.
But it processes tasks sequentially, one after another. I mean, it does it very, very quickly.
But still sequentially, yes.
I've always thought of a CPU like a single brilliant mathematics professor.
Okay, I like that.
Right. Like if you give that professor a really complex calculus problem, they will solve it flawlessly and faster than anyone else in the world.
Sure.
But if you hand that exact same professor a million incredibly simple addition problems, they still have to do them one by one.
Right.
It becomes a massive bottleneck.
That is a perfect functional analogy. And before 2012, that was the fundamental limitation of artificial intelligence research.
Because neural networks don't need calculus.
Exactly. The architecture behind modern AI does not require a brilliant calculus professor. It requires millions, or really billions, of incredibly simple, simultaneous mathematical operations.
You know, it's a massive parallel data problem.
Yes. So the CPU professor was basically choking on the sheer volume of basic math. But meanwhile, over in the gaming industry, you had the GPU.
The graphics processing unit,
Right.
which up until that exact point was viewed by the serious enterprise tech world as just a niche consumer toy.
Oh, completely. GPUs were for rendering video games. They were for making sure the lighting on a virtual race car looked realistic.
Or calculating the trajectory of digital shrapnel in a first-person shooter.
Exactly. But think about what rendering a digital image actually requires mechanically. A standard computer screen has millions of pixels. To render a fully 3D environment, the computer has to constantly calculate the color, the light, the position of every single one of those millions of pixels, dozens of times a second.
You just can't do that sequentially.
No, it would take forever. You need parallel processing. So, to use your analogy, a GPU isn't a single brilliant professor.
What is it then?
A GPU is essentially a stadium filled with 50,000 middle schoolers.
Oh.
Right. None of them can do calculus. But if you give all 50,000 of them a simple addition problem at the exact same time.
They will finish a massive data set in a fraction of a second.
Exactly. So in 2012, the researchers behind AlexNet realized something huge. They realized that the mathematical requirement for rendering a video game, those millions of simple simultaneous calculations, was the exact same mathematical requirement for training a neural network to recognize an image of a cat.
It's the exact same math.
The exact same math. They took these consumer gaming chips, fed the AI data through them, and the results absolutely shattered the previous records for computer vision.
It's like building what you thought was just a highly specialized race car engine, only to realize, completely by accident, that the combustion mechanics are actually the perfect reactor to power a completely new type of city grid.
Yes.
Like, you thought you were in the entertainment business, and suddenly the actual physics of your product make you the most important player in the global energy business.
That realization alone is a great piece of tech history. But, as Holman points out in his analysis, serendipity does not equal strategy. The initial alignment of hardware architecture and AI software needs might have been a lucky accident, but what happened the morning after that realization was anything but luck.
Well, I want to push back on that a bit because in the executive world, we often conflate brilliance with just being in the right place at the right time.
Sure, we do.
We love a hero narrative, you know? Didn't the leadership of this company just happen to have the race car engine that luckily fit the reactor and they just, I don't know, rode the wave?
It is so tempting to view it that way. It really is. But you have to look at the capital allocation decisions that immediately followed 2012 to see why it was a visionary pivot rather than just riding a lucky wave.
Okay, lay it out for me.
Recognizing an emerging use case is one thing. Bet the company execution is another entirely. Jensen Huang and the leadership team didn't just issue a press release celebrating a cool new academic use for their gaming chips.
They didn't just take a victory lap.
No. They looked at the AlexNet breakthrough and realized that the GPU had the potential to completely hollow out the traditional data center, totally revolutionize high-performance computing.
And realizing that meant staring down a terrifying strategic choice, right?
Yeah.
Because in 2012, the market for quote-unquote AI infrastructure essentially did not exist.
It was zero. There were no enterprise budgets for deep learning back then. It was purely academic research. Exactly the point. Homan highlights the sheer magnitude of the R&D investment this required. They had to pivot a highly successful, highly profitable, publicly traded hardware company.
A company whose quarterly earnings were entirely dependent on gamers upgrading their PCs, right?
Yes. And they pivoted into an enterprise AI infrastructure company.
You are essentially standing in front of your board of directors and your institutional investors and saying, "Hey, we are going to take the massive profits generated by our core established market and we are going to siphon them off."
To fund a theoretical future.
To fund a theoretical future where every major corporation in the world needs our chips for something called deep learning, a concept most of their customers probably hadn't even heard of yet.
The discipline required to hold that line year after year, quarter after quarter, before the commercial market fully materialized is staggering.
It's huge.
And for the executive listener, this is really the first crucial takeaway from Holman's piece. Strategic agility is not just about changing your marketing message.
It's about capital.
It's about fundamentally reallocating your capital and your engineering talent toward a conviction about the future, even when the present data tells you to play it safe.
They didn't just dip a toe in the water.
No, they re-architected the entire company around a future they believed was inevitable.
So having the vision and the conviction is step one. But vision without execution is just hallucination, right? Building the actual infrastructure to capture that future is where the vast majority of companies fail.
Yeah.
I want to look really closely at the multi-pronged strategy Holman lays out for how they actually pulled this off. Let's start at the foundational level. The hardware itself.
Okay.
Because after 2012, they couldn't just keep selling off-the-shelf gaming chips to data centers. How did they fundamentally re-architect the compute stack specifically for artificial intelligence?
This is where we really get into the physical mechanics of the silicon. As Holman details, they began a relentless cycle of improving GPU performance, specifically tailored for these new, massive workloads.
Right.
They stopped looking at the chips solely through the lens of graphics, and they started looking at it through the lens of artificial intelligence math.
Yeah.
And the most profound architectural shift in this regard was the introduction of tensor cores.
Okay, I hear the term tensor core thrown around in literally every single enterprise tech pitch today.
Oh, it's everywhere.
But for a business leader trying to grasp the actual strategic advantage, what does a tensor core physically do that a regular processing core doesn't? Let's strip away all the marketing jargon.
Okay, to really understand the tensor core, you have to understand the fundamental mathematics of deep learning, which is overwhelmingly based on matrix multiplication.
Matrix multiplication.
All right. In basic terms, a matrix is just a large grid of numbers. When an AI is learning, it is constantly multiplying massive grids of numbers together to adjust the quote-unquote weights of its neural connections.
Okay.
A standard core, even a standard GPU core, handles these calculations in a relatively piecemeal fashion. It calculates a few points, stores the result, calculates a few more, and adds them up.
So it's fast, but it's still doing the math in chunks.
Right. It's iterative. But a tensor core is a specialized piece of physical hardware etched directly into the silicon that is hyper-optimized to calculate an entire block of a matrix in a single clock cycle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If a standard GPU core is like a worker rapidly calculating one row of a spreadsheet at a time, a tensor core is a specialized machine that stamps out a calculation for a massive three-dimensional cube of spreadsheet data instantly.
And
yes. It fundamentally changes the physical architecture of the chip to natively process the exact type of math required by AI.
So they literally hardwired the specific mathematics of artificial intelligence into the physical layout of the silicon itself.
Exactly.
But, you know, in hardware engineering, whenever you solve one processing problem, you immediately create a new bottleneck somewhere else in the system.
Always.
If the tensor cores are crunching data at that unbelievable speed, getting the data in and out of the chip becomes a massive traffic jam. The processor just ends up starving, waiting for data to arrive.
You're touching on the real issue of scale there. And this is where Holman points to the development of NVLink.
NVLink.
Because in the enterprise world, an AI model isn't trained on one single GPU. A model like the ones powering today's large language models might require thousands of GPUs working in perfect synchronization.
And historically, the way components inside a computer talk to each other is through a standard interface called PCI Peripheral Component Interconnect Express.
Yes, PCIe is the standard highway on a motherboard. But PCIe was designed for general purpose computing.
Right.
When you have thousands of GPUs trying to share massive data sets to train an AI, PCIe becomes a one-lane dirt road. The tensor cores are incredibly fast, but if the chips can't share data with each other fast enough, you lose all the efficiency you gained.
The system literally slows down to the speed of the slowest connection.
Exactly.
So what exactly is NVLink mechanically? How does it solve that?
NVLink is their proprietary interconnect technology.
Yeah.
It bypasses the standard PCIe bottleneck entirely.
It just ignores it.
Basically, yeah. It is a dedicated ultra-high bandwidth, low latency communication pathway that links GPUs directly to one another.
Directly.
Direct connection. It allows multiple GPUs to share memory and transfer data so quickly that, from a software perspective, a cluster of separate GPUs essentially acts as one single gigantic unified processor.
Okay, so they custom built the silicon to do the math, and they custom built the plumbing between the chips to handle the volume. But I have to stop here, because as any software executive will tell you, The most advanced hardware in the world is just very expensive, very hot sand if you don't have the software to make it useful.
Absolutely true.
Hardware does not sell itself to application developers.
And that reality is perhaps the most critical insight in Holman's analysis of their execution phase. The leadership understood that they had to court the developers.
Right.
In any new technology paradigm, developers are the undisputed kingmakers. If a platform requires a developer to learn arcane hardware languages or fight through endless friction just to get a basic result, they will abandon it for an easier alternative.
Even if the easier alternative is slightly slower.
Exactly. Convenience almost always wins out early on.
So Holman specifically focuses on the software layer here. He cites libraries like TensorR and cuDNN. How do these tools fit into that broader competitive strategy?
Let's look at cuDNN first, which stands for cuDNN Deep Neural Network Library. When a developer is building an AI application, they do not want to spend 6 months figuring out the most efficient way to manually program a matrix multiplication on a specific GPU architecture.
That sounds like a nightmare.
It is. So cuDNN provides highly tuned, pre-optimized software implementations for the standard complex routines used in deep learning. It's essentially a massive library of pre-written, hyper-efficient code.
So the developer just calls the function and it works perfectly.
Exactly. And then you have TensorArt.
What does TensorArt do?
TensorArt focuses on the deployment side. Once you have spent millions of dollars training an AI model, you have to actually put it into the real world to answer user queries, right? That process is called inference.
Right, actually using the AI.
Yeah. TensorArt is an optimization software that takes your trained model and automatically compresses it and optimizes it so it runs with the lowest possible latency and the highest possible throughput on the hardware.
I see the strategy here. By providing these deep software libraries, they aren't just handing a developer a raw, incredibly complex chip and wishing them luck. They are handing the developer a fully equipped, perfectly organized workshop where all the heaviest tools are already plugged in and ready to use.
They are systematically hunting down and eliminating friction.
Wow.
And for the executive listener, the strategic takeaway here is profound. This software layer is what transitioned the company from being a mere component supplier, a company that just sells a physical microchip, to a provider of what Holman calls turnkey solutions.
Turnkey solutions. Oh.
They integrated and optimized the entire workflow for very specific workloads.
Because when an enterprise customer is evaluating an infrastructure investment, they aren't just calculating the unit cost of the hardware.
Never.
They are calculating the time, the engineering hours, and the risk involved in actually getting an application to market.
Precisely. You are buying certainty. You are buying a drastic reduction in your time to market. In the enterprise software world, developer efficiency and reliable deployment timelines are consistently valued way higher than the raw theoretical performance of the silicon itself.
It makes sense.
They made it so easy to build on their hardware that it became financially irresponsible for a company to try and build on anything else.
Man. Okay, so we have the micro level perfectly engineered here. They re-architected the silicon itself with tensor cores. They solved the local data bottleneck with the NVLink plumbing, and they wrapped the whole package in a frictionless turnkey software layer like cuDNN.
A perfect micro stack.
Right. But as we all know, artificial intelligence did not stay at the micro level. Over the last decade, the models grew exponentially in size.
Exponentially.
I mean, we went from recognizing grainy pictures of cats in academic labs to massive large language models that can pass medical board exams and write production level code.
It's wild.
And that kind of scale requires a macro level shift. How did they take this perfect micro stack and scale it to the size of a modern multi-acre data center?
This transition is where Holman's analysis really highlights a massive, highly aggressive strategic leap. To survive the era of large language models, they had to stop viewing themselves as a company that puts a component inside a computer server and start viewing the entire data center itself as the fundamental unit of computing.
You know, the data center is the new computer. That phrase gets thrown around a lot in the industry, but what does it actually mean operationally?
What it means operationally is that the scale of the computations outgrew the physical boundaries of a single server chassis.
Okay.
When you're dealing with AI models possessing billions or even trillions of parameters, you cannot train them on one machine. I don't care how many cutting-edge GPUs you cram into it, it's impossible.
It's just physically not enough compute.
Exactly. You have to distribute that singular training task across thousands of servers spread across vast warehouse-scale facilities.
And the moment you distribute a single task across thousands of physical machines, the network cables connecting those machines are no longer just basic IT utilities, right?
No, absolutely not.
The network becomes the central nervous system of the computer itself.
Exactly. This is known in the industry as the east-west traffic problem.
East-west traffic.
Yeah. Historically, data center networks were designed for north-south traffic, meaning data coming in from the internet to a server north to south, and the server sending data back out to the internet south to north.
Okay, that makes sense.
But in an AI cluster, the servers are constantly talking to each other. They are sharing intermediate mathematical results back and forth across the room, east to west.
Ah, I see.
If the network switch connecting rack A to rack B introduces even a fraction of a millisecond of latency, your $100,000 GPUs are just sitting there, completely idle, waiting for the data to arrive over the wire.
Just burning electricity and doing nothing.
Exactly. Which brings us to the strategic acquisitions Holman focuses on in his piece, the most vital one being the acquisition of Mellanox for nearly $7 billion.
$7 billion. At the time, why was a networking company so critical to a chip company that they would authorize that kind of capital expenditure?
Because of that exact scalability imperative we just talked about, Mellanox was the pioneer of InfiniBand.
InfiniBand.
Right, it's a high-performance computing network standard that offered drastically higher bandwidth and lower latency than traditional Ethernet. Acquiring Mellanox wasn't just about buying a profitable side business.
Right, it wasn't just diversification.
No, it was about vertically integrating the last remaining bottleneck.
Yeah.
They needed to control the central nervous system to ensure their GPUs could actually perform at scale.
But Holman goes deeper than just the speed of the cables here. He highlights the development of something called SHARC,
Yes.
Scalable Hierarchical Aggregation and Reduction Protocol. That is a very dense piece of technical terminology.
It's a mouthful.
Walk us through what SHARP in-network processing actually accomplishes in a data center.
To understand SHARP, visualize how data normally moves in a massive AI training run. Imagine hundreds of GPUs, all calculating different parts of a massive equation. Periodically, they all need to combine their results to update the main AI model. Traditionally, all those hundreds of GPUs would send their individual data packets across the network to a central CPU.
Right.
That central CPU would add all the numbers together and then send the updated result back across the network to all the individual GPUs.
That sounds like a massive logistical nightmare. All that data traveling back and forth congests the network and creates a huge latency penalty.
It is incredibly inefficient. So what SHARP does is fundamentally change the role of the network hardware itself.
How so?
Instead of the network switches just acting as dumb traffic cops forwarding packets of data from point A to point B, SHARP embeds actual processing power directly into the network switches themselves.
Wait, so the network switch is actually doing the math?
Yes. As the data packets travel from the various GPUs through the network fabric, the switch itself aggregates the data and performs the necessary reduction math, like adding the numbers together on the fly while the data is still in transit.
That is extraordinary. You are essentially turning the copper and fiber optics into an active part of the processor.
It radically reduces the sheer volume of data that needs to traverse the network. It dramatically cuts down latency. And most importantly, it frees up the GPUs to keep doing what they do best rather than waiting around for centralized updates.
Wow.
By acquiring Mellanox and deploying technologies like SHARP, they finalized their transformation. They went from a component supplier to an end-to-end data center scale infrastructure player.
They took control of the entire physical environment.
Exactly, to ensure that as AI models grew exponentially, the architecture could scale gracefully along with them.
It is a brilliant defensive and offensive move. I mean, they control the chip, the board, the software, and the network
the
fabric.
whole stack.
But let's step back into the shoes of a skeptical business strategist for a second.
Okay, let's do it.
Having the best hardware and the best data center architecture is an incredible advantage today, yes. But hardware alone is inherently vulnerable to commoditization.
Oh, invariably.
Eventually, given enough time and capital, another massive tech conglomerate can figure out how to build a highly efficient matrix multiplication chip and a fast network switch. Hardware margins inevitably compress over time.
They do. If you are competing solely on hardware specs,
Yeah.
you are eventually going to face a race to the bottom on price. It's historically proven.
So here's where it gets really interesting. How does a company lock in its dominance and permanently prevent that commoditization? You don't just build a better product, you build the ultimate moat, right? You build a platform strategy that makes switching impossible. We need to talk about CDA.
CDA, Compute Unified Device Architecture. According to Holman's analysis, the creation and relentless cultivation of CDA is the single most consequential strategic maneuver in their entire history.
The single most consequential.
Yes, it is the absolute bedrock of their monopoly.
I really want to understand the origin of this because I read the section on CDA in Holman's piece, but I'm struggling to see why it constitutes such a massive impenetrable moat. To a lot of people outside the weeds of computer engineering, it just looks like another programming language. What was the exact problem it solved, and why was it revolutionary?
Okay, to understand the moat, you really have to understand the absolute nightmare that was programming a GPU before CUDA existed.
Paint the picture for me.
Remember, GPUs were built for graphics. They were physically hardwired to understand concepts like polygons, pixels, shading, and texture mapping.
Video game stuff.
Right. So imagine you were a scientist in 2004 and you want to use a GPU's incredible parallel processing power to run a complex fluid dynamics simulation.
Okay.
Doing that was incredibly painful.
Because the chip didn't understand the language of fluid dynamics, it only understood the language of video games, right?
Exactly. You essentially had to trick the graphics card.
Trick.
Yeah. You had to mathematically translate your scientific equations into graphics terminology. You literally had to pretend your fluid dynamics data was a 3D texture, push it through a graphics API like OpenGL, let the GPU quote unquote render the data as if it were drawing a picture, and then translate the resulting pixel data back into scientific numbers.
That is insane. That sounds like an absolute barrier to entry. Only a handful of highly specialized engineers would ever bother jumping through those hoops.
It was immense friction.
Yeah.
Almost nobody did it. So what CUDA did when it was introduced in 2006 was shatter that barrier completely. It provided a standard, accessible, parallel computing platform and programming model. It democratized access to the raw power of the GPU.
So you didn't have to pretend to make a video game anymore.
Right. It allowed developers to write programs using standard ubiquitous programming languages like C or C++ Grana directly for the GPU without having to know absolutely anything about graphics rendering pipelines.
Wow.
It opened up general purpose computing on GPUs to the entire world of software engineers.
Okay, I understand the technical achievement there. It's massive.
Right.
But I am going to play devil's advocate here on behalf of every executive listening who is steeped in modern software strategy.
I welcome it.
As we discussed at the very top of the show, the prevailing wisdom in the tech world over the last 20 years is that open source wins.
Right.
Open standards drive adoption, collaboration, and ultimately market dominance. Closed systems, walled gardens, they're usually viewed as a restrictive relic of the 1990s desktop wars, eventually doomed to be overtaken by open ecosystems.
It's common view.
Why did a fiercely closed hardware ecosystem work so flawlessly in this specific instance?
It is a critical question, and it is central to Holman's analysis. CDA is a deeply closed ecosystem in one very specific vital way. It only runs on their proprietary GPUs.
Right.
If you write your enterprise AI application using the CDA platform, you are completely locked into buying their silicon to run it.
Yeah.
Cannot take a CDA program and run it natively on a competitor's chip.
So it is the ultimate vendor lock-in. But again, why did the developer community accept that lock-in instead of demanding an open standard that would work across all hardware? Developers usually hate lock-in.
Because in the bleeding edge world of high performance computing, performance, deterministic reliability, and stability absolutely trump the philosophical ideal of openness.
Reliability wins.
Every time. By maintaining uncompromising, tight quality control over both the hardware architecture and the CUDA software stack, they can fine-tune the integration between the two to an obsessive degree.
You mean the closed system is actually a feature, not a bug, when it comes to stability?
Let's push that further. Imagine you are a major cloud provider or an enterprise AI lab. You are spending $100 million on a massive AI training run that will take 3 months to complete.
Okay, a huge investment.
You cannot afford a situation where an open source driver conflicts with a generic compiler and causes a kernel panic 3 weeks into the run, corrupting all your data.
That would be a disaster.
A total disaster. You don't want a fragmented ecosystem of different vendors pointing fingers and blaming each other for the crash. You need absolute bulletproof optimization and reliability.
You need one throat to choke.
Exactly. You need one throat to choke. The tightly closed ecosystem allowed them to guarantee a level of performance and stability that an open, fragmented standard simply could not match.
And strategically, this exclusivity creates a beautiful, inescapable trap that drives hardware sales.
It really does.
You attract the developers by providing this incredibly robust, easy-to-use software platform, Dashuta. You spend years supporting them. Those developers build amazing, indispensable, world-changing applications on top of that platform.
Yep.
And then the enterprise customers who want to use those applications realize they have absolutely no choice but to buy the underlying proprietary hardware to run them.
It is vendor lock-in. But it's a lock-in built on genuine compounding value creation rather than artificial contractual restriction. And this leads directly to the most powerful, unyielding force in business.
Network effects.
Network effects.
Let's break down the actual mechanics of that flywheel. How does it spin?
Holman points out that the company became a formidable ecosystem builder, aggressively seeding the market. They relentlessly supported the growing community of CDA developers long before it was profitable to do so.
They were playing the long game.
Very long. They provided robust developer tools, massive pre-trained libraries, extensive technical support, and they partnered with major universities, tech companies, and cloud providers to ensure CEA was taught in computer science classes and integrated everywhere.
So step one, obsessively cultivate developers and make them happy.
Yes. Step two, those highly supported developers build an incredible diverse array of applications exclusively on CEDA.
Okay.
Step three, because all the best, most essential enterprise applications are only available on CEDA, major companies are forced to buy the compatible hardware.
They have no choice.
Right. Step four, because the hardware has a dominant market share, the next generation of software developers are heavily incentivized to learn and build their new projects on CEDA because that is where all the customers are.
And the flywheel spins faster and faster.
It reaches a critical mass where it sustains its own gravity.
Exactly. Holman notes that this extensive decade-long support brought the platform to a critical mass where widespread adoption fuels exponential growth. It transforms isolated developer efforts into a cohesive, dynamic, massive, value-generating network.
Right.
And once that specific type of developer network effect is established, it is nearly unbreakable for a competitor.
Because even if a well-funded rival manages to design a chip that is historically difficult to build, and it turns out to be, say, 20% faster on paper and 20% cheaper,
it simply doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter at all, because none of the existing enterprise software ecosystem runs on it. The switching costs for an enterprise to rewrite their entire software stack to support a new, unproven chip architecture are astronomical.
It is like trying to sell a revolutionary, incredibly fast smartphone that doesn't have an app store and doesn't run any existing applications.
Perfect analogy.
No one is going to buy the hardware, no matter how cheap it is. So we've traced the entire playbook here. You have the initial vision, the flawless hardware and software integration, the scaling to data center architecture, and the unbreakable CUDA network moat.
Right.
You are now dominating the market. You are the monopoly. What does a genuinely visionary leadership team do next?
They don't just sit back.
No, they don't sit back, defend the fortress, and fight for scraps in legacy markets. They invent entirely new ones. They systematically create blue oceans.
This is a core tenet of Holman's thesis that really separates them from historical hardware companies. They consistently focus on pioneering innovative solutions rather than replicating existing business models.
They don't just iterate.
No, they leverage their foundational AI research and their massive locked-in ecosystem to push into commercial domains that literally did not exist a decade ago.
Because the innovator's dilemma usually dictates that successful companies get trapped trying to squeeze a few more cents out of their existing customers, right? Fighting Intel or AMD for a slightly larger share of standard server CPUs would be the traditional play. But Holman specifically lists domains where they avoided that trap. Neural graphics, autonomous vehicles, advanced robotics, and medical imaging.
Yes.
Let's explore how they actually execute this.
Let's look at medical imaging as a prime example of market creation. Mm-hmm. They didn't just walk into major research hospitals and try to sell them generic server GPUs to replace their CPUs.
Right.
They understood that doctors and medical researchers are not computer engineers. They do not want to learn how to write low-level code. So the company built application-specific platforms.
They verticalized the solution.
Precisely. They took their core architecture and tailored a specific hardware and software stack designed exclusively for the immense computational demands of real-time MRI reconstruction, or high-speed genomic sequencing.
Wow.
They built tools like Clara, an AI healthcare framework. They created tailored environments that allow medical professionals to immediately leverage cutting-edge AI to detect anomalies in X-rays or simulate molecular structures for drug discovery.
All without having to build the underlying tech infrastructure from scratch themselves.
Exactly. And we see the exact same playbook in autonomous vehicles. They aren't trying to manufacture physical cars.
No, that's a terrible margin business.
Right. But they are providing the absolute essential underlying computing brain. They built the specific hardware platform and the massive software simulation stacks required to process inputs from cameras, radar, and LiDAR, all in real time.
If we pull back and connect this to the bigger picture, the strategic takeaway for executive leaders is the profound difference between market creation and market capture.
It's a huge distinction.
By asking themselves, we have the most powerful compute engine in the world. Where are the impossible computationally gated problems that only this engine can solve? They completely avoid the commodity trap.
And by solving those impossible problems, they create multi-billion dollar industries out of thin air. It is a testament to how visionary leadership drives profound industry transformation. They successfully transformed from a consumer gaming company to an enterprise AI infrastructure company to a fundamental, irreplaceable enabler of global robotics, automotive design, and healthcare.
And crucially, by providing the full stack platform for these new industries, they effectively set the industry standards before their competitors even realize a new market has formed.
They are miles ahead before the race even starts.
So, how does this historical multi-layered strategy manifest in the present day? We've traced the lineage from the 2012 pivot to the re-architecting of the stack, to the creation of the CUDA moat, to the pioneering of new markets.
Right.
Let's turn to the most recent proof point available to the market, the Blackwell platform.
Blackwell, introduced recently at their GTC event, Blackwell is the current ultimate culmination of everything we've been discussing today.
It's the pinnacle.
Holman's analysis highlights it as a massive leap forward in consolidating their AI leadership for the next generation.
We've talked a lot about the architecture, but what are the actual technical leaps here? Why does Blackwell matter so much, considering they were already dominating the market with their previous generation, the Hopper architecture?
It matters because we are hitting the physical limits of traditional silicon manufacturing.
The actual physics of it.
Yes. There is a physical limit to how large you can make a single microchip. It's called the reticle limit.
The reticle limit, okay.
Blackwell represents a massive architectural advancement because it essentially stitches two maximum-sized dies together so seamlessly that they operate as a single unified chip.
Oh, wow. So they just combine two maxed out chips into one brain.
Exactly. This allows for drastically faster inference speeds, which
Huh.
is how quickly the AI can generate a response, and massively accelerated training capabilities. It is architected specifically to support the next generation of multi-trillion parameter AI models that the previous architecture simply would have choked on.
But let me ask the ultimate executive question here. Faster is great, bigger is great. Trillions of parameters sound impressive. But what does this all mean for the bottom line? Because at a certain point, the sheer capital expenditure of building, cooling, and running these massive AI supercomputers has to become economically prohibitive for customers.
Right. And that constraint, the economic barrier to scale, is the exact target they are attacking. Holman's conclusion zeroes in on this precise economic reality, and it is arguably the most important point of his entire analysis.
Okay.
Their fundamental strategy, at its absolute core, is about relentlessly reducing computing resource costs.
Wait, I have to stop you there because their chips are famously incredibly expensive.
They are.
The market knows companies are paying tens of thousands of dollars for a single high-end GPU. How can a strategy based on charging an extreme premium for hardware be fundamentally about reducing costs?
Because you have to stop looking at the unit price of the silicon and start looking at the total cost of ownership, TCO.
Total cost of ownership.
Right. In a modern warehouse-scale data center, the cost of the hardware is only one piece of the puzzle. The ongoing operational expenditures, specifically electricity, physical real estate space, and the massive cooling infrastructure required to keep the machines from melting, are astronomical.
Right. Data centers are physically constrained by the amount of megawatts the local power grid can actually supply to the building.
Exactly. So look at what Blackwell does. It brings substantial energy efficiency gains. If a new platform costs twice as much to purchase up front, but it can do 10 times the computational work using only a fraction more power.
And takes up half the physical space in the server rack.
Exactly. The actual cost per individual computation plummets drastically.
I see. It is not about the capital cost of the chip. It is about the operational cost of the output.
Precisely. By radically enhancing performance and drastically reducing the operational footprint, power, space, cooling, and the sheer time it takes to train a model, Blackwell fundamentally lowers the TCO for running massive AI infrastructures.
And the macroeconomic effect of that reduction in TCO is utterly fascinating.
It really is.
It's a classic example of induced demand, or Jevons paradox. By making advanced AI computing vastly more affordable and efficient per unit of work, organizations don't just pocket the savings.
No, they never do.
They use the efficiency to scale their infrastructure even further.
Yes. Because computing becomes cheaper and more efficient, companies attempt to build vastly larger, significantly more complex AI models. They attempt to solve much harder scientific and business problems that were previously economically unviable.
Which drives further aggressive technological advancements across all industries.
The company is essentially lowering the economic barrier to entry for the future.
Which, paradoxically, expands their own total addressable market even further. It's a completely self-sustaining, virtuous cycle of economic scaling.
A perfect loop.
They build wildly faster hardware, which lowers the aggregate cost of compute, which allows their captive developers to build dramatically more ambitious software.
Which, in turn, immediately requires the next generation of even faster hardware to run effectively.
And because of the CUDA moat, they control the entire loop.
That is the ultimate synthesis of Holman's analysis. The deeply integrated, closed ecosystem attracts and locks in the developers, and the relentless engineering drive to continuously lower the economic cost of compute ensures that those locked-in developers can actually afford to deploy their wildest, most demanding ideas into production.
Let's do a quick, comprehensive executive summary for our listeners to really crystallize the sheer scale of the strategy Victor Holman has laid out here.
Good idea.
We have spent the last hour deconstructing a phenomenal corporate playbook. First, we explored the crucial element of spotting the vision, recognizing in 2012 that a specialized gaming processor was actually the skeleton key to general artificial intelligence.
Right.
And executing a terrifyingly bold reallocation of capital to bet the company on a non-existent market.
Second, we analyzed the flawless execution of re-architecting the entire compute stack. They didn't just build faster hardware, they introduced fundamental physical changes like tensor cores.
They solved data bottlenecks with NVLink.
And critically, owned the full software layer with tools like cuDNN to provide turnkey solutions that obliterated developer friction.
Third, they recognized that the data center was the new unit of computing. They acquired networking pioneers like Mellanox and developed in-network processing like Sharp to ensure their massive GPU clusters could actually communicate efficiently at scale.
Fourth, they constructed the ultimate platform moat. They built a closed ecosystem via CUA, prioritizing absolute performance and reliability over open standards.
Which created an unbreakable developer network effect that essentially guaranteed hardware sales.
And finally, they utilized that unprecedented dominance not to fight legacy wars, but to pioneer entirely new blue ocean markets in healthcare and robotics.
All while relentlessly driving down the total cost of ownership to induce demand and ensure continuous exponential growth in AI complexity. It is, frankly, a breathtaking, flawlessly executed corporate strategy.
It is a masterclass.
Mm-hmm.
But Holman's analysis is rigorous precisely because it doesn't just look backward to praise past victories. He ends his piece by looking to the horizon.
Right.
And his conclusion raises a vitally important question, actually a series of existential questions that every technology executive needs to deeply ponder.
Lay them on me. What is the actual threat on the horizon here?
Well, we have clearly established over the course of this briefing that the closed ecosystem, the tightly coupled exclusive combination of CUDA software and proprietary GPU hardware, has been the absolute engine of their historic success.
Without a doubt.
But looking at the next 5 to 10 years, if advanced computing becomes exponentially cheaper, more efficient, and universally ubiquitous because of their own relentless innovations,
yeah,
what is the medium to long-term impact on the competitive landscape?
Right. It's the trillion-dollar question. Can they realistically hold the fortress forever?
Exactly. Can any single company realistically maintain a tightly closed, highly lucrative ecosystem as the rest of the market, which comprises some of the most well-resourced technology conglomerates on the planet, scrambles to catch up?
It's unlikely.
We're already seeing massive consortiums of competitors attempting to build open-source hardware interconnect standards and open software layers specifically designed to break the CUDA monopoly.
Because historically, in the technology sector, when the industrial bakery is that profitable and the demand for the bread is that universal, eventually someone figures out how to build a competing oven.
They always do.
Well, the sheer gravitational pull of these multi-billion dollar markets, combined with a universal enterprise desire to avoid vendor lock-in, eventually force a fracture in the landscape.
It's a real possibility.
Will enterprise customers ultimately demand open standards to regain leverage, even if it means taking a slight hit to raw performance in the short term?
And if that fracture happens, if the market does begin to commoditize and standard open source layers become viable, how does an incumbent behemoth, a company that has optimized its entire culture, pricing model, and architecture around being a sole source monopoly provider, adapt to a deeply fractured, highly commoditized environment?
That is the big unknown.
It will be the ultimate test of long-term strategic resilience.
It is a profound structural question, and it is something every leader listening today should be thinking about, not just in regards to the AI silicon market, but for how the life cycles of platform strategies, vendor lock-in, and ecosystem dominance might apply to the future of their own specific industries.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us for this executive briefing. We set out today to deconstruct the architecture of dominance, and thanks to the rigorous analytical framework provided by Victor Hollman, I believe we have comprehensively mapped exactly how you build the most important infrastructure monopoly of the 21st century. Until next time, look closely at the platforms your business relies on, and keep thinking about what happens to the market when the locked doors finally open.